now.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وَأَوْفُوا بِعَهْدِي أُوفِ بِعَهْدِكُمْ وَإِيَّايَ فَارْهَبُونِ وَآمِنُوا بِمَا أَنزَلْتُ مُصَدِّقًا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون تتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتموا الحق وأنتم تعلمون وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واركعوا مع الراكعين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran rejects claims about granting the International Atomic Energy Agency access to individuals as part of its inspections of the country's nuclear program. Israeli forces clash with protesters holding a fresh rally in Tel Aviv to protest the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And China announces a rise in its annual military budget amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a wide range of issues. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, Iran has rejected claims about granting the International Atomic Energy Agency access to individuals as part of its inspections of the country's nuclear program. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the issue was not even raised during the visit by the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi to Tehran. Behrouz Kamalvandi added that there was also no discussion about unrestricted access to the alleged three undeclared locations where the agency claims to have found uranium traces. He also stressed that Iran's agreement with the IAEA during Grossi's visit complies with a law passed by the Iranian parliament to counter sanctions and develop the country's nuclear program. As part of the agreement, Iran said it will voluntarily allow the agency to conduct more verification and monitoring activities in case such activities are needed. After arriving in Vienna, Grossi claimed that the agreement includes access to people of interest.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has said that there is, quote, great expectations about his ongoing talks with Iranian officials over issues concerning their cooperation. The remarks sent a positive signal on the course of cooperation between the agency and Tehran. That positive assessment was also echoed by Mohammad Islami, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization.
The Islamic Republic will in no way compromise on its national interests and its national security. These meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain a professional relationship based on trust, and that we attach great importance to abiding by the IAEA safeguards.
Eslami added that IAEA reports have confirmed that Iran has not enriched uranium beyond 60% and that issues regarding claims that some uranium particles have been found in undeclared sites in Iran have been resolved. Grossi, for his part, said that the discussions are being held in an atmosphere of honesty and cooperation. Asked to comment on claims that IAEA has adopted a political approach towards Iran, he insisted that the agency is not a political tool for any country.
The IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent. I am under no country's instructions. And we act in a way that is very transparent. Member states have a board of governors. Every step we take is scrutinized. And I think that what is important is to work together, as the Vice President was saying, work on the cooperation, which is very important, on peaceful uses, work on the observance of the comprehensive safeguard agreements, and all the rest is speculation.
Grossi was also asked by reporters present in the presser to comment on the Israeli regime's total lack of accountability regarding its nuclear weapons program. Grossi said that there are limitations to the agency's inspections of those that have not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
That being said, let me conclude this important question by saying that every country in the world should be party, should be a member of the non-proliferation treaty.
The visit appears to have helped improve relations between Iran and the IAEA, particularly scientific and technical collaboration between them. The two officials said that Iran's annual nuclear science conference, which has so far been held on a national level, will be upgraded to an international conference from next year.
Both sides have expressed satisfaction with the talks, and Mr. Grossi himself has called the atmosphere positive, which could pave the way for the revival of the nuclear deal. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
People have staged a sit-in in the Syrian capital, Damascus, calling for an end to the U.S. and Western sanctions on the Arab country. The bans are making life harder for people across the nation, particularly following the recent earthquakes there. Our Syria correspondent Mohammed Ali has more in this report.
Syrian political parties, along with Syria-based Palestinian factions, have gathered in Arnous Square in Damascus, calling on the U.S. and its Western allies to lift economic sanctions on Syria. Speakers said this Western siege on Syria is inhumane and requires urgent actions by the international community, considering that people in Syria are dealing with deteriorating economic conditions following the recent earthquakes.
We express our anger over the unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. Syrians suffered a lot as a result of such unjust and inhumane actions. Not lifting them is a crime against humanity. We call on the U.N. to shoulder its responsibilities and try to get such sanctions lifted.
We reiterate our support for Syria and reject the unjust seizure act, which led to shortages in basic needs. We call on the U.S. to stop looting Syria's resources and get out of the Arab country. We also call on Arab and Islamic nations to stand beside Syrians dealing with crises. We call on the Arab League to give Syria a seat back to the country.
Participants raised Syrian and Palestinian flags as well as banners asking for an end to the decades-long bans that have deprived them of their basic needs and resulted in a surge of food and medicine prices.
This is an unjust siege. We as Syrians are suffering from this siege in all aspects of our daily lives, starting from transportation, because the bans have caused a lack of fuel as well as shortage in medicine and also high food prices. All that is because of the imperial blockade.
Life changed so much following the sanctions. Prices went high. People are searching for their basic needs. This siege caused a shortage of so many basic commodities. We call on the world to do something and help us.
The recent earthquakes have further worsened the already deteriorating economic and humanitarian situation in Syria. The UN says even before the earthquake tragedy, 70% of the population needed humanitarian assistance due to the war on the country. One challenge after another, Syrians endured so many hardships in the past decade that made living a normal life a daily challenge. U.S. and EU sanctions exacerbated their suffering, and they demand an end to such injustice. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Now, the weeks-long protests in Israel have once again turned violent. Regime forces used water cannons to disperse the protesters blocking a main highway. Tens of thousands of people hit the streets of Tel Aviv for the ninth Saturday in a row to protest the judicial reforms proposed by the far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Israeli forces, some on horseback, also blocked some streets in an attempt to contain the protests. The protesters are angry at the new cabinet's plan to curtail the judiciary. If approved, that the legislation would increase the cabinet's influence in choosing judges and limit the powers of the Supreme Court to overturn the cabinet's decisions. Over the years, meanwhile, the Israeli regime has put restrictions on Palestinian access to agricultural lands and water resources in the besieged Gaza Strip. But despite all these cruel measures, some Palestinian farmers have found unique ways to thrive and overcome the status quo. Ola Elassi has more for us in her report.
Farming is a fundamental part of the Palestinian identity and history, deeply rooted in the culture of land and the struggle for freedom. After decades of Israeli occupation, organic farming has weakened significantly. Now, Palestinian farmers are finding new ways to revive the economy and maintain their heritage through innovative, sustainable farming methods. We spoke to Aid Abu Ramadan, who's one of the pioneers of vertical farming.
I'm actually a civil engineer, but I have inherited this passion for agriculture from my father and grandfather. Actually, due to the Israeli occupation and the agricultural land is shrinking every day, So it came to my mind that we need to plant something that gives more per unit of land. So I was thinking of intensive agriculture as well as vertical agriculture.
Abu Ramadan is optimistic about the success of the project. He emphasizes the need of vertical farming as a means for Palestinian farmers to show resistance against Israeli violations.
This model of vertical agriculture is the first model in Palestine. It's an experiment, but it looks really promising. I hope that we will continue with vertical and intensive agriculture in order to help our Palestinian farmers. But first, we need the know-how, we need the technology, we need the knowledge to bring to them, because we know that vertical and intensive agriculture is the future for Palestinian farmers.
Palestinian farming is suffocating under the Israeli occupation, with its two basic resources of land and water illegally controlled. The Israeli violations have increased unemployment and poverty rates in Palestine and exacerbated the already dire humanitarian situation.
Israeli violations against the Palestinian agriculture include firing at farmers, leveling agricultural land in the area around the fence, preventing farmers from working in their fields, aerial spraying of herbicides along Gaza's perimeter fence, and dumping of farmers' land in eastern Gaza. The Israeli occupation has placed bans on exports of agricultural goods from the besieged Gaza enclave. The regime imposes impossible conditions on Gazans farmers with the intention of decreasing the quality of the Palestinian product and reducing their marketability abroad. Furthermore, Israeli denies entry of the agricultural equipment and certain fertilizers.
Israeli occupation is not simply limited to harming civilian population, damaging buildings and infrastructure. It's fundamentally aimed to destroy the Palestinian lands and environment in order to put pressure on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and cut their links with the motherland. Al Al-Asi, Gaza.
Turning elsewhere, China's military budget has risen by 7.2% this year, slightly outpacing last year's increase. The national budget released on Sunday showed some $224 billion has been allocated to military spending for the year 2023. Beijing says armed forces should work to carry out military operations, boost combat preparedness, and enhance their military capabilities. This year's hike in defense spending marks the eighth consecutive single-digit increase. The upswing in the defense budget comes amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a wide range of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Moving on, people have held a candle vigil in Athens in memory of the victims of the recent deadly train collision. Protesters, mainly young people, attended the rally in front of the country's parliament building. The protest is one of several in the last days in Athens and other cities in the country. Many of the protests have erupted in violence, with protesters throwing stones and petrol bombs at police who responded with tear gas. They are angry over the failures of successive governments to improve rail network safety. A passenger train collided head-on with a cargo train in central Greece late on Tuesday. It killed at least 57 people, many of them students. The government says human error was to blame, but unions say it was caused by a lack of maintenance and faulty signaling. Many countries in Africa have traditionally maintained good relations with Moscow. Some of them include South Africa, Burkina Faso, Mali, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who are keen to expand ties not only with Russia, but with China as well. The French president is on a four-nation African tour. He has promised not to interfere in African countries' internal affairs and to focus mostly on trade. But are African nations, especially former French colonies, keen on expanding this reset? It seems that Emmanuel Macron has another reason for his visit.
Of French interference in Africa had ended. These were the words of the French President Emmanuel Macron before departing for his African tour, which begged the question, didn't his African tour mean that it had not ended? Macron's destinations, Gabon, Angola, Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. His goal, to restore its influence after a series of military and political setbacks. Africanization, as opposed to Francafrique, which Macron said is over. But what is Francafrique? Francafrique refers to the time after the wave of decolonization in 1960, when France propped up dictators in its former colonies in exchange for access to resources and military bases. Some of France's colonies in West Africa included Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Benin, Guinea, the Ivory Coast, and Niger. Macron and his predecessors, notably François Hollande, have said that the policy is dead, and that France had no intention of meddling in sovereign affairs. But not all Africans are buying it. Like this Congolese resident who said that France was turning its attention to Central Africa because of a breakdown in relations with former West African colonies. To say that France has a crisis or breakdown in relations on its hand is an understatement. On the one hand, Macron has repeatedly sought to shake off the label of former colonial power, motivated by commercial gain. And when it comes to France's military involvement, the security crisis in West Africa's Sahel region had fueled anti-French protests, bringing juntas to power in Burkina Faso and Mali, which did not want long-standing military ties with France.
Now, chaotic scenes in Peru as police and anti-government protesters clash in the capital, Lima.
Hey, muchacho, ¿qué pasa?
Protesters are calling for early elections and the resignation of President Dina Boluarte. They also demand the release of ousted President Pedro Castillo. The rallies began in December after then-President Castillo was forced out of office and was replaced by his vice president, Boluarte. The protesters want Castillo to be freed. He is now in pretrial detention for attempting to close Congress to avoid an impeachment. Dozens of people have been killed during the months-long protests.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight. The chief executive of BP, Bernard Looney, speaking in London at the International Energy Week, has said more investment in the oil and gas sector is good for the fight against climate change. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Bloomberg News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. As the sound of climate protesters reverberated through the conference room, BP's Chief Executive Officer Bernard Looney made the case that investment in more oil and gas is crucial for the transition away from these very fuels. Reducing supply without also reducing demand inevitably leads to price spikes. Price spikes lead to economic volatility, and there's a risk that volatility will undermine popular support for the transition, Bernard Looney said at London's International Energy Week. He added, "We avoid that outcome by investing in today's energy system as well as investing in the transition." The executive's pitch at the event, one of the City of London's biggest fossil fuel conferences, follows the company's recent announcement that it would cut oil and gas production more slowly than expected this decade. The move is part of a realignment for BP as it aims to drive returns with existing businesses that contribute to climate change, while building new businesses that cut emissions from the economy. The company's strategy is partially due to the need to fill the gap in the world's energy supplies in the fallout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. For the first time last year, investment in clean energy matched funding for fossil fuels, according to a report by the Bloomberg News Agency. The world is far behind the trajectory of emission cuts that would enable it to reach the goals set out in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement and prevent the worst impacts of global warming. The use of oil and gas will need to decline in order to get on track. Conference attendees were greeted by protesters against the fossil fuel industry who criticised Bernard Looney's approach. "Climate crisis is a plague, Bernard Looney to The Hague," they chanted, referring to the location of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, as they sat blocking the door to the conference entrance early on Tuesday, 28th of February. Inside the building, criticism of BP's approach continued from the stage. Simon Morrish, Chief Executive Officer of British renewable power company Exlinx, said BP's plans to continue investing in fossil fuels showed that it isn't moving fast enough to address climate change. Simon Morrish added, "That lacks a massive amount of ambition." Russia Today has also covered this story and tells us more. BP's Chief Executive Officer Bernard Looney has said more investment in the oil and gas sector is needed in order to ensure an orderly transition away from those same fossil fuels. The British executive made the pitch on Tuesday, 28th of February, during International Energy Week in London, amid soaring energy prices and climate protests.
Bernard Looney explained his logic by arguing that reducing supply without also reducing demand inevitably leads to price spikes, and that price spikes lead to economic volatility. If that happens, he said, there's a risk that volatility will undermine popular support for the transition. Bernard Looney's proposed solution is to invest in the existing oil and gas system, as well as investing in the transition to more climate-friendly sources of energy. As Bernard Looney made his pitch, protesters were blocking the entrance to the Intercontinental London Park Lane Hotel, where the energy conference was taking place. Activists held signs reading, "Climate criminals enter here," "No new oil," and calling for Bernard Looney to be tried at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, Netherlands. Earlier this month, OPEC Secretary-General Haitham al-Qais similarly called for a pause in climate change talks. Haitham al-Qais argued that the country is chasing green energy, needed to slow down and look at the big picture. They should work towards an energy transition that is orderly, inclusive, and helps ensure energy security for all, he added. Fossil fuel prices have soared since Western countries imposed unprecedented sanctions on Russia last year in response to the conflict in Ukraine. The restrictions were meant to punish and apply pressure on Moscow as one of the world's biggest producers and exporters of oil and natural gas. However, the effect was the exact opposite, with energy prices in Europe soaring sky high amid limited supply. In December, Europe again tried to hit Russia's position in the oil market by imposing a price cap on seaborne crude exports from the country. However, an International Energy Agency report from earlier this month revealed that these sanctions had merely helped Moscow to find new oil markets, with exports to China reaching a new record high.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. As always, we'll be looking at a story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll dissect it from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to look at the recent incidents of blasphemy against the religion of Islam, which have taken place in Sweden and Denmark, specifically the burning of the Holy Quran in a deliberate attempt to provoke Muslims around the world. These desecrations actions have outraged Muslims and have sparked a debate about where the red line should be drawn between freedom of speech and incitement to religious hatred, as the following report explains.
A sight growing all too common now. Muslims protesting in response to a row over blasphemous depictions, ridicule, or desecration of the Islamic faith. Islamophobic activists attacking items or historical personalities Muslims adore, in some cases with state support. A recent example which angered Muslims was a series of Quran burnings in Denmark and Sweden, conducted by a far-right anti-Islam activist. The incident sparked worldwide protests, with Turkey also blocking Sweden's NATO bid amid Swedish authorities' defense for the burnings as freedom of speech.
This is not a freedom of expression. There is the act of burning here. You are lighting a fire. And what are you burning? You're burning a thought. There is no freedom of expression here. There is only an insult. There is an action. There is an act of burning. But they will see what they burned. God will surely punish them.
The Islamic holy book isn't the only target. Islam's beloved Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has routinely been caricatured by Islamophobic artists. These cartoons have been used to offend Muslims, with some British schools adopting the images to push Western views on blasphemy to students. The 2022 Batley Grammar School scandal was a prime example. A teacher showing students the upsetting images, sparking protests by Muslim parents. A 2022 sectarian movie, The Lady of Heaven, which depicted the Prophet, peace be upon him, his companions and family members on screen, also sparked worldwide anger. The film was later defended by Islamophobes. Critics claim Muslims are trying to enforce medieval blasphemy laws onto the West, while Muslims believe they are being denied their human rights to practice their faith without discrimination. Either way, the debate on Islam and blasphemy remains a hot-button issue.
Well, joining us in our London studio to talk about the issue of blasphemy and Islam is Roshan Mohammed Saleh, who is the editor of Muslim news website Five Pillars. And also joining us over Skype from Manchester is Sheikh Mohammed Omar, who is the chairman of the Ramadan Foundation. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Roshan, before I come to you, I'm going to speak to the Sheikh on Skype and get his views on the subject. Sheikh, perhaps you could just tell us, what is the Islamic position on blasphemy, and what can we as Muslims tolerate when it comes to this issue?
It's a very delicate question you've asked, which has been debated for over 1,400 years. I have certain views regarding blasphemy and the consequences of it, which mainstream may not agree with. So I think you should make a separation. Number one, this act is totally unwarranted. It is an insult not only against Muslims, but against all people. Targeting religious figures that we admire, that we look up to, our role models, even Christians or Jewish, intellectuals and highly revered individuals, is something which should be condemned by all people. And especially this provocative act of burning the book of Allah, the Quran, which the Muslims hold very dearly to our hearts. This isn't an act of, freedom of speech or freedom of action. This is a deliberate attempt by a certain, certain people to activate or to get a response, which will unfortunately be something which none of us would welcome. But generally speaking, on blasphemy, I would give one sentence. I don't, in my research that I've done, I don't think that blasphemy is something which is a capital punishment. I'm not saying insulting Islam is legitimate, but I'm saying that's a major debate that we as scholars and academics need to have in the future. But this act, I wholeheartedly condemn it. And my argument to that was engagement. We must engage with everyone. So I would welcome these right-wing people to sit with us, and if they've got any questions, if they want to criticize us, if they want to condemn us, if they want to ask us any questions, let's do it in a civilized manner. We're open to discuss with them, but what we're not open to is being insulted, and especially burning of holy book.
Sure. I'm going to jump in there, Sheikh, and bring Roshan into the discussion. Now, Roshan, obviously, you've been working as a journalist for quite some time. Mm. You must have seen over the years the rising trend of Quran desecrations, insults against Islam's prophet in Europe especially taking place. Tell me, why do you think this is happening?
And before I get there, can I just respond really quickly to something that the Sheikh said?
Yes, you can.
He raised a very interesting point about the Islamic position on, you know, the punishment for blasphemy. Mm. And I think that's something for the scholars to discuss. But I think the mainstream position actually, in an Islamic context, I'm not talking about in the West, but in an Islamic context, in an Islamic country, is actually, it is capital punishment for, you know, that kind of blasphemy. And I think Sheikh Mohammed will agree with me on that, and his position, I think, is a minority position, and I think he would agree with that. In terms of why this is happening, I think it's because Europe is lurching to the right. We have political instability in Europe. We have wars going on. We have a cost of living crisis. So I think people are looking for a scapegoat, and the scapegoat are brown foreign Muslims, foreign-looking Muslims. And even the mainstream politicians, I mean, we have the hard-right politicians, the crazy people who go out to provoke, but even the mainstream politicians in Europe are kind of stealing their clothes. They're lurching to the right because they want the votes of the right-wing masses who have been inflamed by the media against Muslims. And at the same time, we see that there's a big Muslim presence in Europe growing. I think there are about, 4 million now in Britain. There's 6 million in France and Germany, similar numbers. And we have held on to our religion. We haven't assimilated like, perhaps the Hindus or the Sikhs or the Jews have to the same extent. We've held tight to our beliefs. So on the one hand, Europe is lurching towards the right, and on the other hand, the Muslims are sticking tight to the rope of Islam, to the rope of Allah, and the rope of the Prophet. So that has inevitably led to this kind of clash.
Sheikh, come back in on this. Obviously, Roshan brought the other side of perspective on one of the points you raised about the scholarly debate, perhaps, over the capital punishment on blasphemy and that type of thing. But I also want to ask you about the narrative that's pushed here in the West, that basically Muslims should just kind of like it or lump it when it comes to blasphemy. I mean, surely Muslims have a right to protest, even a democratic right to protest against these types of desecrations.
So I don't want this discussion to go in the avenue or the direction of discussing the religious justification or the religious background or realities surrounding blasphemy. And that is something that scholars will debate. Yusuf al-Qardawi has debated it, many modern scholars, and that's a debate that academics and ulama should have. But bringing it to the context of this discussion today, Robert, I've been involved with interreligious dialogue, intrafaith dialogue, working with the media, working with non-Muslims since the early 2000s. And I can remember when Denmark, when the cartoons happened, presenting to an audience of Denmark journalists in London and trying to explain to them how we as Muslims feel when you insult the most beloved thing towards our Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And Roshan is right to an extent that the reason behind that is because of religious intolerance and certain sentiments that are happening in the West. One of the great qualities we have in the UK is multiculturalism, diversity. And this is taken from the Kant philosophy that England adapted multiculturalism when they invited minorities to come to this country, unlike the French, who believe in total integration, assimilation to their system. So, you know, Muslims, alhamdulillah, we all wholeheartedly to our religion. We love our Prophet. We love our Quran. We will defend our Prophet in the best of manners and in the best of ways. But at the same time, we have to be able to convey our sentiments to these people, to the majority of people. What they are attempting to do, and they've done it many times throughout the last 10 to 20 years, is aggravate the Muslims and get what we call a response which isn't civilized. And you can't really blame some young people when you insult them and you swear at them and you swear at their Prophet and you insult their Quran. And you're
for
going
sure.
To
I'm going
to
jump in, Sheikh. I'm going to jump in, Sheikh, because we do have limited time. We also hit the streets of London over the weekend to ask Muslims and non-Muslims about the blasphemy issue. Here's what they had to say.
If we all agreed, then we'd be one religion, right? So there are differences of opinion, but you respect other people's opinions and understanding of how what they believe in, but you do not attack. And the Quran, it says that don't curse their gods because they will curse our gods, right? And also in the Quran, it says, لَكُمْ دِينُكُمْ وَلِيَ دِينَ. You have your religion, we have our religion. And deen can be interpreted as you have your way of life and I have my way of life.
I was brought up Church of England, but we have this tradition in this country where we have a lot of satire, and I'm very comfortable with the Church of England being satirised, and I really enjoyed watching Jerry Springer the musical, which satirised the whole Christian belief, or Monty Python, Life of Brian. You know, I can see the funny side, but on the other hand, I don't want to upset people. So I think if people are being aggressive against religion, any religion, not just Church of England, then I think that would be a step too far. But from my own point of view, having been brought up in England and being aware of the history we have of satire going right back to the 18th century with Jonathan Swift, we're just so used to mocking ourselves, we don't take ourselves seriously. So I think I can see both sides of the argument.
Freedom of speech and freedom of the press are really important in principle, but we have to self-regulate. We have to exercise self-discipline. And we can disagree, but let's disagree politely. Let's respect other people. And sure, have whatever views you like. I believe in a free society. That sort of behaviour is going to incite violence. And of course, incitement to racial hatred, for example, it's a criminal offence. And so it should be.
Freedom of speech is that everyone can say whatever they feel like, but then you have to bear with the consequences, don't you? So if you insult a religion and then you get attacked for it, or something happens to you, then you've got to bear the consequences. If someone doesn't want to believe in God, they don't have to, but I think they should keep their hatred for it silent, so you don't have to go around. Like, I don't agree with everything in life, but I don't go around insulting other people or saying, you don't have to say your views everywhere you go. You can keep it to yourself, get on with your life.
I don't think so. Like, people should criticize other religions irrespective of their own religions. Other than that, I think they should be respectful towards each other and be in harmony.
I do believe in free speech. However, I do also believe in that doesn't make you free from consequences. So if you say something, and like, for example, because this is coming off of the guy burning the Qurans in Sweden, which you just told me, if something happens to him, no one is going to be surprised.
Well, there you have it. Some interesting opinions from London streets. So, Roshan, what did you make? I was quite surprised that there wasn't perhaps more support for discrediting Islamic symbols.
There wasn't more. No, not everyone in Britain is crazy, you know. And, yeah. You know, non-Muslims in this country, they have considered opinions as well. And I think we saw those in the Vox Pops. It wasn't a monolithic kind of, we hate Islam. That's not the case at all.
And what about, you know, the fact that we live in a secular society here as Muslims? Mm. So do you think that there's perhaps a sort of position that we as Muslims have to find where perhaps we have to put up with some of this criticism of Islam that we don't like?
I think we already do. I mean, yes. I mean, even from I'm an advocate of wherever you are, whether you're in a Muslim country or a non-Muslim country, just take the Islamic line. If you're a Muslim, that's the easiest way. Just argue for what Islam says and don't worry about anything else. And if you can't do that for whatever reason, maybe you'll go to jail or you'll get, you know, your bank account closed, then don't say anything. But I think that what we're asking for in this country is not special treatment. It's equal rights, you know, and I mean, maybe we can come on to this later, but I mean, we can't go around burning the Torah or, you know, the LGBT flag, or we can't go around, you know, inciting hatred against other minorities. And Muslims are just asking for the same. They're asking for the same equal rights. We're not guests in this country. We're citizens, you know. So, you know, we shouldn't be comparing ourselves as British Muslims to Muslims abroad, maybe in repressive regimes in the Muslim world. We should be comparing ourselves to non-Muslims in this country who enjoy more rights than we do and are given more respect than we are.
Sheikh, let me bring you back in on this. Now, obviously, you've mentioned a few things, the work that you do in society, for example, to try and promote, build bridges, essentially. But there is a debate here about whether Muslims should, I don't know, ignore these types of actions, desecrations and so on, or whether we should go out into the streets, protest, make our voices heard and that type of thing. Where do you stand on this? Because surely Muslims have to do something or else it's just going to continue.
Well, Muslims have every legal avenue that's available to them to reply to this incitement. I think what's extremely important in a modern context is that we have real leadership. We saw that recently, a few years ago at the UN, when the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, defended the honour of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam in the best of manners, and he articulated the reason why over a billion Muslims were hurted when he's insulted. So we need more political leaders like that. We need more people like other leaders around the world that come out and express themselves and explain on a world, at an international level, why these incitements hurt Muslims. We need more engagement of governments at a governmental level to do that, the UN, to pressure certain governments on not, curtailing this type of, or advocating this type of, incitement. We need Muslim leaders to be able to explain in Jummah khutbahs what avenues do we have. We as Muslims should be responsible. Irrespective of how they insult us, we should be civilized in replying back to them and being able to express our views. Unfortunately, Roshan has mentioned a very important point. We shouldn't compare ourselves to Muslims in Jordan or other countries that do not have the freedoms that we have in this country. And Muslims, yes, there's no denying that Islamophobia is on the rise. Muslims are being targeted. But we have to also take ownership of Western phobia that certain Muslims may advocate. I'm not trying to equate both of the things, but we've got a major responsibility of really presenting this deen to these people and explaining to them that, the reason why we believe this is wrong, and be Muslims. Just live as a Muslim according to the Quran and according to the prophetic way, and you will see the best of this part of that, inshallah.
Sure. Roshan, I'm going to ask you the same question. Do you think that Muslims should be going out into the streets, protesting outside Swedish embassies, for example, burning Swedish flags in response? Perhaps this is too much, or do you think this is an acceptable response?
I'm not against burning the flags. I think with every action, there's a reaction. So I'm not going to condemn people that want to burn the Swedish flag. It's not something I would personally do, or I think is the wisest course. I think we should be better than our teachers. I think the response should be on two levels. On a state level, I mean, I like what Turkey's doing, basically saying that, right, Sweden, you're not going to join NATO anymore. I mean, I don't agree with Turkey being part of NATO in the first place, but leaving that to one side, that is a price that Sweden is going to pay now. If they're going to insult the Prophet or let that happen, give them police protection, the Quran burnings, then they're going to pay a price. So I like that idea that, if you do this, you're going to pay a price, and a serious price. The words of condemnations from other Muslim states, it's weasel words, isn't it? Because they're still doing business with Sweden, like they're still doing business with India, despite the fact that there's an anti-Muslim genocide going on in India. On a personal level, yeah, I think we should raise our voice in protest, but I also think this is a great dawah opportunity. I had this idea, I'm not claiming copyright over it, but basically of translating the Quran en masse into Swedish, the Swedish language, and distributing it for free.
Flooding the market,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, distributing to free to Swedish people in the streets, in the high streets, in the malls, just literally flooding Sweden with the message of the Quran. And that is something that I think as Muslims we can finance. It's very doable. And we all know that when, like yourself, well, how did you convert to Islam? I was born Muslim, but I became more practicing when I read the Quran. First of all, the meaning of it in English, then later on in Arabic, because your heart melts when you read the Quran. And we know that happens. So that would be a perfect response, wouldn't it?
It would be. And let me come back to you, Sheikh. We haven't got a lot of time left in the show, so perhaps about a minute or so to respond. What do you make of this? Surely it's a good dawah opportunity, right? People are talking about Islam, at least, even though the Quran was desecrated in this case.
It's obviously we condemn the burning of any holy book, not just Islamic, any holy book, attack on any religious figures. It's not the way civilized people behave in civilized societies. But I think this is a golden opportunity for us Muslims to showcase to the world the beauty of our Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. When he was attacked, when he was mocked, when he was humiliated in Mecca by the Meccan elites, his response was the best, in the best of manners. Even in Medina, when they ridiculed him, he behaved, he replied in the most moral of manners that we can do. So we should demonstrate to them what is Islamic behavior and give the Quran to everyone. And inshallah, you will see a rise with this incitement, hatred. You will see a great number of people, inshallah, coming to the deen of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we pray Allah will protect our deen and protect our Prophet and unite the Muslims on these issues. What we need, Brother Robert, is all Muslims to come together. Unfortunately, we are so segmented, so divided, but these are issues that can unite the Ummah so we can have a unified answer against this incitement.
That is very true. I have noticed that the incident, of course, as upsetting as it was, it did bring the Ummah together behind one issue. There were thousands, millions probably around the world that came out to condemn Sweden for this, and Sweden has suffered politically as a result of that. So in a way, it's almost like a victory, would you say, in this case with the Ummah?
Allah works in mysterious ways. And whenever there's a negative, there's a positive. Whenever there's difficulty, there's ease. And when the worst things happen to us, the most upsetting of things that inflame us, it often, you know, ends in a good way. And it's always an opportunity to, bring more people to the light of Islam, to let them see the beauty of our religion, this fantastic way of life. And inshallah, I pray that more Swedes convert to Islam as a result of this.
Well, I know that Islam is the fastest growing religion, I think, in the Western world right now, especially in Europe. And without a doubt, every Quran that's burned makes no difference because so many Muslims memorize the Quran. So even if every Quran was burned, God forbid, there would still be Muslims that could just write down, recite it at any given world. Millions, in fact, I think, around the world.
Allah has told us that he will preserve the Quran till the end of time.
So they can do whatever they want, but ultimately they just look like fools in the end and Islam will continue to grow. Roshan, I think that's a great way to end the show. Thank you so much for your time, and to you, Sheikh, and to everyone else at home as well for joining us. But that is it for this week on Islam. But don't worry, we'll be back next week, inshallah, for another edition. But for now, assalamu alaikum.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and let us listen to a thought-provoking saying from the Prophet's vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. A wise man first thinks and then speaks. And a fool speaks first and then thinks.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Viewpoint, and I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And we have two dear speaker guests here with me, Brother Ali and Brother Muhammad. Welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in this episode of today, we're going to discuss one of the most controversial issues of Islamic world about Palestinian issues. So, as you know, Palestine is one of the most valuable lands and regions in Islam thoughts and also other religions. So, in this episode, based on the leadership statements, we're going to discuss this issue.
She's standing on the rubble of her home. She cries out for her parents.
And everywhere in this world, the people, the youth people, are the next generation of leaders and the next decision makers. And particularly because we are Palestinian, and you know, we have been living under the Israeli occupation for more than 60 years. We have a more pardon in order to lead our nation and to fight for our rights, and also to try to develop the situation that the Palestinian people live in Palestine, in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, which unfortunately is going from worse to worse each day.
The right of return is still the major cornerstone of the Palestinian issue. And